and welcome to the Deep Dive Radio Show. As always, I'm your host, Nick Espinoza, and we're going to be talking about all things cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology related, and I think we're one of the only ones out there that's doing that right now. If you'd like to be part of the radio show in any way, shape, or form, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. Or you can send us an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. We have an action-packed show as always. There's always a lot to cover, so stick around with us as we deep dive into a topic and we catch up on everything else. So without further ado, let's begin. And we've got a great hour for you. We're going to dive right in with the news. But before that, I just want to let you know to stick around for basically the deep dive this week. We're going to be talking about the water system throughout the entire United States. There's over 50,000 different water supply departments, and we are at serious risk for a cyber attack that actually puts the national health here in serious jeopardy. So don't miss this deep dive. But like I said, we're going to start with the news, and thanks for sticking around. And in Apple news, Apple's App Store is apparently full of scams. And here's what's going on. This is coming from the Washington Post. Apple's chief executive, Tim Cook, has long argued that it needs to control app distribution on iPhones. Otherwise, the App Store would turn into a quote-unquote flea market. But among the 1.8 million apps on the App Store, scams are hiding in plain sight. Customers for several VPN apps, which allegedly protect users' data, complained in Apple App Store reviews that the apps told their users that their device had been infected by a virus to dupe them into downloading and paying for software that they don't need. A QR code reader app that remains in the store tricks customers into paying $4.99 a week for a service that is now included in the camera app of the iPhone itself. Some apps fraudulently present themselves as being from major brands such as Amazon and Samsung, and on and on and on. Now, of the highest 1,000 grossing apps on the App Store, nearly 2% of those highest grossing apps are scams, according to analysis by the Washington Post. And those apps have billed customers out of an estimated $48 million during the time they've been on the App Store, according to the market research firm App Figures. The scale of basically of this problem has never before been reported until this report, and it's just fascinating. What's more, Apple actually profits from these apps because it takes a cut of up to 30% of all revenue generated from the App Store itself. Even more common, according to the Post analysis, is the fleeceware apps that use inauthentic customer reviews to move up in the App Store rankings and give apps a sense of legitimacy to convince customers to pay higher prices for a service that are usually offered elsewhere with higher legitimate customer reviews. And so this is a huge, huge problem. Two-thirds of the 18 apps that the Post flagged from Apple were removed from the App Store, but obviously many do remain. This also talks to basically brand trust. You trust Apple more than you might trust that app, that you're getting. And therefore, if Apple says it has good reviews or Apple has vetted it or quote unquote vetted it, there you go. So beware of the Apple Store and what you are getting. It could be a scam. Do your homework, do your research, make sure it's from legitimate companies. And that is your Apple news of the week. And in your right to repair your own equipment news, we may have a right to repair law here in the United States sooner than later. Now, here's what's going on. This is coming from Gizmodo, and I think this is absolutely interesting and important. I've talked about this on the show before. The right to repair movement has finally made it to Congress. About 2 weeks ago or so, Congressman Joseph Morrell of New York filed legislation that would make it easier for consumers to fix their broken gadgets without having to fork over even more money to the original manufacturer. If passed, the Fair Repair Act would require manufacturers to give device owners and third-party repair shops access to replacement parts, diagnostic information, and tools needed to repair their electronics. To date, the most right to repair legislation has been introduced at the state level, but this bill would establish a nationwide standard. And I quote the congressman, "For too long, large corporations have hindered the progress of small business owners and everyday Americans by preventing them from the right to repair their own equipment. It's long past time to level the playing field and put the power back in the hands of consumers. This common sense legislation will help make technology repairs more accessible and affordable for items from cell phones to laptops to farm equipment, finally giving individuals the autonomy they deserve." Now, under Congressman Morrell's bill, the Federal Trade Commission would be allowed to penalize companies found in violation of the legislation. Penalties would include forcing manufacturers to pay damages or even give refunds to customers. And as it stands, you typically have to go through your manufacturer's official repair channel to get your device fixed, which can be both expensive and time-consuming, not to mention oftentimes ridiculous, since you've already paid for the product in the first place and nobody wants to shell out hundreds of dollars for a busted iPhone when a cheap fix could solve the problem. The Right to Repair movement aims to make device repairs less of a headache for consumers while also pushing back against the trend of planned obsolescence, a practice in which the manufacturers create products that are designed to be needlessly phased out and tossed into the world's ever-growing e-waste pile. So far, 27 states have begun working on some form of right to repair legislation independently, although it would be nice to see a national one. Companies such as Apple and John Deere, both of whom are notorious for enforcing some of the most restrictive repair policies to the detriment of their customers, argue that these restrictions are necessary to prevent intellectual property theft and maintain the device's integrity. However, the FTC basically called bunk on that argument last month, and in a lengthy report to Congress, the agency said there is quote-unquote scant evidence to justify the hoops that companies make consumers jump through when it comes to repairs. And I think that this is absolutely interesting in the sense that as we are talking about this, Apple and John Deere are really good examples of this. Now, I believe in a right to repair. I think that if you buy an iPhone or a MacBook or, you know, even an Android or an HP Windows laptop or a computer, you should have the right to basically pop the hood and swap out parts or fix these things. But that is going to be a serious hindrance to Apple, and they know it, which I think is part of the logic here, in the sense that in order to get their iPhone, for example, or the iPad, and now the new iMac, which is razor thin, basically as thin as it is, they don't typically use things like screws or other methods that allow somebody to easily disassemble this, which is why they consistently flunk things like environmental certifications when they are trying to basically say that, yes, you can easily disassemble for recycling our products, because Apple has been gluing screens onto cases. You know, they've been using other adhesives. So once you've torn that adhesive up, or you've unglued, if you will, it's very hard to get things back together. John Deere basically keeps a very tight lid on the firmware that essentially runs their tractors. And there you go. Oftentimes, a lot of people know how to, you know, wrench their gearheads. They know how to wrench on their own stuff. And if you do that, you're voiding the warranty on your very, very expensive tractor, especially if it's new. So that's a huge problem. Now, I think there are some things that probably shouldn't have a right to repair. This might be, let's say, critical medical equipment that if you don't have the proper training and you're trying to repair it on the fly, you know, that might malfunction and obviously cause somebody harm or worse. You know, we saw a lot of people trying to fix ventilators during the height of the pandemic, which at that time, I honestly, if I was a manufacturer, would turn a blind eye to, because they couldn't keep up with the ventilator repairs and all this kind of stuff as you know, hospitals were getting overrun. But in regular times, when we're not in an emergency or a panic mode where some of those restrictions might be able to be lifted, repairing your own ventilators is probably going to be a bad thing for a lot of people, you know, and maybe they're simple to fix. You know, I'm not a ventilator expert, but you get what I'm saying here. The last thing I would want is you fixing that laser scalpel that, you know, that doesn't get fixed right and you burn a hole through somebody that you shouldn't. So these are the things I'm talking about. But right to repair is, it looks like it's coming. Hopefully this will pass. I think it's a good thing overall. And so hopefully you'll get more control of your devices, much to the chagrin of Apple and John Deere. So we'll see where this goes. And that is your right to repair news of the week. And in charity news, I wanted to sit down with a charity to talk about how charities have survived the pandemic. I mentioned this on my last show. And so with me today is Laura Fillenworth, the executive director of Keen Chicago, to talk about just that. And Laura, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Nick.
And just real quick for my listeners, can you tell my audience about Keen, what Keen does, what you guys are all about?
Sure. Keen Chicago provides free sports and recreational programming to youth with disabilities ages 5 through 21. So we use a volunteer-based model to have volunteers work individually, one-on-one, with youth with disabilities so that they can practice sports in a way that is accessible to them.
That's great. And I think that's really important to have a safe space, you know, for activities like that and everything. But coming from the pandemic, which obviously is what we're talking about here, you know, a lot of charities really had to hunker down. And, you know, in the case of Keen, because you're interacting, you know, with the kids and the athletes, as I know you call them, you know, on a regular basis, we really couldn't do that during the pandemic. So by virtue of that, you know, in terms of technology, in terms of just interacting, you know, with the kids, with their parents and everything, what did that look like during the pandemic for Keen?
It has been a huge challenge, although it has been one that we have managed successfully. For most of our population, Keen is the only program that the youth that we serve have access to. There aren't other programs that meet their needs. There aren't other places where they go to connect with their friends or to play sports. So we knew that keeping the youth that we work with connected was going to be very important during this time. So we transitioned online almost immediately. We had our first online session on March 20th, 2020. So we started meeting online. There was a learning curve to figuring out online programming and figuring out how to make our online programming then accessible to the range of disabilities that we serve and the age range that we serve as well. We found out that not every family had access to computers or access to internet because of the demographics that we serve. So that was a huge challenge as well. And we worked really hard to then make our programming also on demand for them. And we also sent activity kits directly to our athletes' homes, so that we could still encourage our athletes to engage in physical activity, even if they weren't able to participate with us live.
Wow. And that seems like a huge undertaking, you know, especially for a charity. And as you mentioned, if you're the only game in town, I think it becomes beyond important, you know, to make sure that you're serving those that you continue to serve. You know, one of those things I think that also happened during the pandemic, which hit a lot of charities hard, is a lot of people simply went out of work. You know, there, you know, we went through essentially a mini recession, or depression or something along those lines. And so by virtue of that, you know, I'm just curious to know how charitable giving during that period, you know, for Keen was affected. You know, did you notice that there was a downtrend? Did you actually make more during the pandemic in terms of donations? What did that look like for you?
At Keen Chicago, we have put a lot of effort and energy into our fundraising. It was a huge challenge and continues to be a huge challenge without the ability to hold in-person events. Our in-person gala was canceled last year. We did hold it virtually. We raised about $20,000 less than we would in a typical year. However, we were able to use other sources to increase donations in other areas. We held our first virtual race. It wasn't really a virtual race. It's called the NEK. It's actually the second annual NEK is happening right now. You can still register. It's a accessible activity event where you pick a physical activity and participate in support of our athletes. So I'll share the website later. You can register for that. We also had a virtual dance-a-thon and increased our grant outreach in order to make sure that we were making ends meet.
So then by virtue of that, just simply adapting to the times, you know, you can't get together to have a race. So let's do it online in whatever way, shape or form that you can do. I think that's actually a really smart idea, you know, especially since everybody's home, everybody's stuck on Zoom and all of that. And so now that we're emerging from this, obviously it's 2021, you know, sitting in Chicago, obviously there's a good chunk of us that have been vaccinated and people are starting to, you know, get together again, you know, not need masks, not hunker down as much. What is that looking like now that everybody's emerging and, you know, the athletes are getting back together, or can they get back together right now? You know, and if that's the case, what is that looking like?
There is still the need to adapt, although we are in the process of resuming our in-person program. We haven't resumed yet. However, we will begin meeting in July. It is still a challenge because a significant portion of the population we work with is unvaccinated, since some of them are younger than 12, and also vulnerable since they have disabilities or other health conditions. So we are going to meet, but we are going to follow some strict safety protocols. Initially, we're going to meet outside. We are going to reduce capacity so there's fewer people on site, and reduce our volunteer numbers as well. So there's a variety of ways that we're going to keep people safe. We're also going to add some structure to our program. Not that there wasn't structure before, but we tried to do things in a way that would offer the youth with disabilities that we worked with a lot of choices. That was something that was empowering to them, and they could always be doing something that they enjoy. And now going back, we will need to add an additional layers of structure so that we have reduced equipment on site, so that we're not chronically sanitizing equipment, because I think that would be too challenging. So we're looking at, instead of offering keen sports, we're going to do keen yoga and keen tennis and things like that. So there is still the need to adapt and rebuild our programming, but I can't wait.
Right, right. And I think as everybody's emerging, you know, it's going to be a challenge to figure out those things, especially, you know, when you have a charity that requires you to interact. You know, so many different charities, you just simply send off your $10 a month or whatever that is, and, you know, they do whatever. But with an interactive charity, it's got to be an uphill battle. And so thank you for your time. I really appreciate this. I think it's just really important to understand that, you know, as we're emerging from this pandemic, you know, one thing that a lot of people aren't really thinking about is they're re-energizing their own personal economies as they're getting jobs and, you know, getting out of the house and all of that, that, you know, charities are still there. And I think it's kind of important. And so if somebody wants to learn more about Keen or get in contact with Keen, how can they find you?
Yes, we are on social media. We would love for you to find us on Facebook and Instagram and LinkedIn. Our handle is Keen Chicago, K-E-E-N Chicago. You can also find our website, keenchicago.org, or email me at info@keenchicago.org. And I am happy to answer any questions that you have about sponsorships, donating, volunteering, enrolling an athlete. We are happy to welcome you to our community.
Great, great. And once again, Laura, thank you so much for your time, and obviously best of luck to Keen. Take care. And before we head over to the next segment, I wanted to let you know, and I've done this in a couple of shows, and I keep being reminded to do this, and I always forget. Basically, if you didn't know, I put out content on a daily basis, not just here on the radio where you're listening to me, but actually I put it quite a lot of places, daily podcasts and videos on some of the latest trends, technology, cybersecurity, privacy, all these kinds of things I keep day to day. And some of the segments that I do for my news section or even my breaches of the week every Sunday gets translated into this show. But I do this as essentially a labor of love. You know, I don't have any kind of monetization anywhere. I just do it to keep people informed and to keep everybody interested. But you can find me basically on Twitter or Facebook at @NickAESP or on LinkedIn and YouTube at @NickEspinoza. And please follow me. I'd love to basically get a shout out from you and you know, send me a message or whatever it is. But I do content daily and I hope you guys enjoy it. And so that is my quick blurb. And in social media news, my question today is, should teens' social media posts disappear as they age? Now, this is coming from the Washington Post, but I'm mostly talking off the cuff here. I think we all grew up in an era where we were really glad, or most of us did, where we were really glad that all the stupid things we did in high school essentially didn't follow us there because there were no cameras. It wasn't recorded. There was no permanent record of this. And as the Washington Post mentions, there is a woman named Alexia McCammon, who is 27 years old, and she was appointed the editor-in-chief of Teen Vogue at age 27, and then suddenly racist and homophobic posts that she tweeted 10 years earlier when she was 17 resurfaced, and she was eventually fired. And so that basically begs the question, do we believe in humans' capacities to change? Do we believe that we can evolve on these situations? You know, was the past 5 years of Ms. McCammon's posts on social media, you know, perfectly fine, you know, not an issue? When do we forgive and when do we not? And I think that's a very important issue. I think I'm going to dive deeper into this as a topic, you know, for a future radio show after I do my homework. But this is what's happening right now. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, because odds are, like me, you grew up in an era where there wasn't cameras and cell phones in your face recording every stupid antic. And so should our kids get a reprieve? Should at some point these simply go away, or we forgive and forget? Think about it, and I'm sure we'll catch you next time on that one. So that is your social media news of the week.
You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. And now for Breaches of the Week. And if you have a data breach to report that's local to you, or the major news might have missed it, please, by all means, send it to me, and I'm glad to give you a shout out and include it in the radio show and possibly a daily video. And you can find me on Twitter and Facebook at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. Or you can email questions at securityfanatics.com. Again, that's questions at securityfanatics.com. And I am more than happy to include your data breach and give you a shout out on the air. With that, let's begin.
And the last couple of weeks in data breaches has just been just off the rails as usual. I obviously handpicked just the top breaches that I think impact you, my audience, the most, and exclude the rest. So here's a pared down version of Breaches of the Week, as always, on the show. And as always, I'd like to thank the following people that sent me this, linked me, tagged me, sent me a whole bunch of these breaches. It is always, always appreciated. And that is Jacqueline Wolf, David Walker, Jason Dance, Barrett Peterson, Chris Fellon, and Scott Newberger. And with that, let's start with a couple of updates. The first one from Electa. If you recall, these are the ones that run radiation machines for hospitals and other outfits. And so we have been seeing breaches basically being declared by healthcare institutions across the United States for the last couple months or so. And the last couple of weeks is no different. So this now we are talking about cancer centers of Southwest Oklahoma, St. Charles Health System in Oregon, and Renown, the health provider in the state of Nevada. So if you use any of those three, heads up to you, you may be involved in a data breach. Same with Capture RX. That's the other one I keep updating you guys on, and these last couple of weeks are no different as well. And so Catholic health locations that had to declare breaches are Mount St. Mary's and Sisters of Charity hospitals here in the United States. Also, Title Health out of Maryland also declared a data breach thanks to Capture RX. So if you use any of them, you too may also be caught up, just like our Electa friends. Now, with that, let's move on to JJ Keller. They provide Department of Transportation compliance services. And on May 10th, JJ Keller detected suspicious activity on their systems, basically located or associated with a company email account. And so on May 21st, they notified one of their largest customers, AmeriGas, that this 8-second breach exposed the records of 123 AmeriGas employees present in the files that were viewable to the attacker. If you didn't know, America's largest propane provider is AmeriGas, so hopefully this was contained, as they have millions of customers. Moving on, let's talk about Southwest Airlines. They grounded their entire fleet amid a giant computer outage. Now, at the moment, we still don't know if this was a simple outage for a non-threat reason, like a bad update or a misconfiguration, but if it's determined to be a cyber attack, I will let you know. Heads up, Southwest Airline travelers. Moving on, let's talk about supermarket chain Wegmans. They've begun notifying customers about a security issue that may have exposed some shopper data, according to a news release about 2 weeks ago or so. The grocery store chain said a configuration issue inadvertently left two databases used for internal business purposes open for potential outside access. The data we are talking about here are customer names, addresses, phone numbers, birth date, shopper club numbers, email addresses, and passwords for access to Wegmans.com. Basically, those are the accounts that were included in this database. The actual characters that a customer type in for their passwords, though, were not exposed, meaning the passwords were obfuscated, hopefully encrypted.
Social Security numbers and any payment card or banking information were not impacted, according to them. And they said they first learned of this problem around April 19th of this year, although this configuration issue started in 2018. So it's been open for around 3 years or so. This issue has been fixed and information has been secured. But heads up to you, Wegmans shoppers. Moving on. Let's talk about Carnival Cruise, that's massive cruise operator. They said about a week ago or so that they detected unauthorized access to their computer systems in March, after which it alerted regulators and hired a cybersecurity firm to investigate. The breach affected the personal information of some guests, employee, and crew for Carnival Cruise Line, Holland America Line, Princess Cruises, and also their medical operations, according to Carnival. So heads up, if you've ever gone on a Carnival cruise or any one of those lines, you may be affected. Moving on, let's talk about CVS, the massive pharmacy chain here in the United States. In another example of a misconfigured cloud service impacting security, over 1 billion records belonging to CVS Health have been exposed online. A couple of weeks ago, Website Planet, together with the researcher Jeremiah Fowler, revealed the discovery of an online database belonging to CVS Health. The database was not password protected, had no form of authentication in place to prevent authorized entry, and here we are. Upon examination of the database, the team found over 1 billion records that were connected to the U.S. healthcare and pharmaceutical giant, which owns the brands CVS Pharmacy and Aetna, including others. And I'm pretty sure that if you've ever shopped at a CVS, you know that half a billion of those records fit onto a single receipt. Moving on. Let's talk about the Florida Department of Children and Family Services. This is actually an update. A woman who was involved in a data breach with basically DCF in Florida, basically in 2019, that affected 2,000 people and over $260,000 in retail theft, has been transferred to Miami-Dade County and was in court on Saturday. That's right. She basically seems to be the cause or one of the causes of this data breach. Now, Bertinancy, I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly, Garcia, aged 50, a former employee with the Miami office for the Florida DCF, is facing 17 counts of unlawful compensation and reward for official behavior, 16 counts of official misconduct, 10 counts of public assistance fraud by an official, and a count of organized fraud more than $50,000. Obviously, Ms. Garcia is not having a good week. We'll see where this goes, but if you have anything to do with Florida DCF, you may possibly be entitled to compensation.
And stay tuned to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show as we take a quick break for a public service announcement. We'll be back right after that.